Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B. Today's guest is Eric Budd, 22 years of volunteer and career experience, a recently promoted technician on Rescue Squad 3 for the DC Fire Department. As Eric began his career, deep down he always wanted to go and work for a metropolitan-sized department. In 2014, he took a leap of faith and applied for a lateral transfer and was accepted, thus living the dream. Eric started out on the engine, but the ultimate goal was to be assigned to one of the three squads in DC. There's no secret that if you have a goal in mind and want to achieve it, the work has to be put in, point blank. And Eric Budd is a true example of this. With that, I present Mr. Eric Budd.
My name is Eric Budd. Joined the fire service in 2002, so 22 years of combination of volunteer and career service. Started my time out volunteering with the Berlin Fire Company, which is just about 10 minutes outside of Berlin, or outside of Ocean City, I'm sorry. Held the offices of captain and assistant fire chief there. Lots of good experiences with fires and crashes. Got hired by the Ocean Pines Fire Department as a firefighter EMT in 2005, and then was fortunate to have a program there where I was able to go to paramedic school through them. They provided a means for that. And then I also worked part-time for Ocean City Fire Department for a while. And in 2014, the opportunity to go to DC as a lateral transfer as a firefighter paramedic presented itself. I applied and got hired in October of 2014. I was assigned as a rookie out of training school to Engine 26 in the Brentwood section of Northeast DC. I completed my probation there and then was fortunate enough to transfer to Engine 15 in Anacostia in Southeast DC. I did 5.5 to 6 years there, and my goal throughout my entire career has been to make it to the Rescue Squad Company. And that opportunity presented itself. I was fortunate enough to pass the process there. And just recently, back in February, was fortunate enough to complete the testing process for technician. So currently assigned as the technician for Rescue Squad 3 on platoon number 1. And living the dream, man. Living the dream. So all's good. Was fortunate enough last fall to be offered a position teaching with Traditions Training on the side. So trying to get the ball rolling with that. It's kind of been a slow start for me, but I've just been putting the priority on making sure that I'm prepared for this, you know, getting the new technician spot and getting settled into that. So we'll see what the future brings in 2024.
Awesome, man. So I already got a couple questions I want to ask you on it. You were on a previous fire department, of course. Was the dream always to go work for DC? Is that what you always wanted?
Yeah, I mean, you know, every guy who wants to be a fireman sits down and watches YouTube videos or whatever, and you dream of what it would be like to be a big city fireman. And you know, sometimes things just fall into your lap at the right time. You know, I where I live is 2.5 hours from the district, so you know, as you're aware, I've heard you talk about the PG DC thing a lot and some of the culture there. You know, we leave early. We leave at 4:30 in the morning. Typically my entire shift is there between 4:30 and 5. So with me living 2.5 hours away, that gets me getting up at 1:45 and leaving at 2 a.m. to get to work. So, you know, some of those challenges you just kind of have to take with it, but it's also part of the cool part of working there. Like the culture of everybody being there at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, you get all the station duties done, get your rig checked. And when the sun comes up, you're ready to hit the ground running. You know, we're housed with Engine 15 and, the chief ambulance and, you know, EMS supervisor. So we're trying to help those guys out as much as we can, hit the ground running and, you know, try to get the station duties out of the way. That way we can do whatever else we need to do, support those guys while they're taking the beating on the streets. So,
hey, I personally love that, the whole going in early, relieving the crew, like just taking their stuff off for them, putting your stuff on the truck, ready to go,
get everything kind of done, but like you said, before the sun come up, and then you know, you guys are ready to start your day. I've been fortunate. I'm sure you know who I'm about to announce here. I'm friends with J-Bo, and watching how you guys do things at that station, the camaraderie, the breakfast, Saturdays are for the Bays, just the whole DC aura, like the culture of it. It's just it's phenomenal.
Yep. J-Bo Boogie's a great representation of what the culture of Fire Department's about, as far as just, you know, loving every minute of it, dedicated, and you know, wears 15 engine on his sleeve for everybody to see. It's great. You know, packing the lines right, running the lines right, taking your company seriously and representing, and, you know, a little bit of trash talk along the way, but that's the fun part of an aggressive company that's squared away and ready to go is, you know, they're not afraid to put the target on their back because they know at the end of the day, it's going to make them better. It's going to serve the citizens better. And that's what we're here for. So it's good.
It's awesome. Okay. My next question for you. So I've talked to individuals, other individuals, I had their names in my head and I was like, try not to go blank, but I'm going blank. Steven Van Ness, and Alex Pluto, both DC firemen. So yeah, I kind of know the by talking to them what the test is for to become a technician for an engine. Where you guys have like short streets, long streets, of course, a pumping practical, things of that nature. What do you do for the squad? Because the squad doesn't have a pump, but I'm sure you also need to know the area. So just asking, what's the test like to become a technician for a squad?
So the abbreviated version would be the same, what they call the knowledge of the box alarm area test. It's the first due alarm area for the rescue squad, which is, there's only three of them in the city. So basically a third of the city. You have to know the running routes verbatim from the firehouse to specific intersections, just like they have for fire alarm pull boxes. Also short streets. So, you know, you have to have the stuff from the book for that, and then stick maps and complexes. In order to move on the process, you have to have a 70% on that test. After that, you would go to the training academy and do a written test that has like all of the IFSTA manuals, pump and driving operations, rules of the road, DC regulations, etc. Pre-trip inspection and driving course. And then the final portion of that test, the practical portion that you're referring to, is a skill station where you have to perform all the technical skills a rescue squad would perform. And, you know, part of the technician role is to be able to lead your crew through some of that stuff and, you know, identify problem solving issues with equipment or the rig. So, you know, for example, you have to lead an extrication, and during the extrication, they're going to present you with some troubleshooting stuff. Well, you may have a pump failure, or a breaker may pop off, or you may have a failure of your gas operating equipment or whatever. And you have to be able to identify the problem and fix it, or give them a secondary solution. So it just basically tests your ability to work through the problems and lead your crew. And that covers every facet of what the rescue squad will go through. So ropes, vehicle extrication, trench, confined space, cutting a vehicle, metering, you name it, boats, boat operations. For us, collapse and trench are a big thing. So being squared away with those, and at the end of the day, the guy who passes all the stuff and has the highest score gets the job. So,
fantastic. I like the process. I don't want to like. Well, I am going to sound like a fanboy, but I just like the way DC. Like, you guys still have map books. You have to know streets. Yeah. Just the old school facet, like the tradition of writing in the book, calls that you ran, the times, the location, who was there, just. It's just the history. The history never goes away when it comes to DC.
Yeah, and you know, to that same thing, like I can very vividly remember my first week as a rookie in the school, and or you know, as a recruit at that point, walking in, and one of the chiefs comes in for one of their introductions. He's like, "This is the DC Fire Department. We have hooks. We don't carry, you know, it's not called a New York hook. This is a hook." Like, he was basically saying, like, this is like, we use our phrases, to a better thing for that is like, we take runs, somebody calls on the phone, you know, it's a wagon, they don't really refer to it as the engine, or they ride the side of the truck. You know, the terminology stays there, and us using it keeps things alive and well, you know, keeping the journal Like you can go in any firehouse and look in there wherever they store them. Each firehouse has a different place, but all the journals from the beginning to current are there. So you could look at what the guys were doing. You know, you go to Engine 24 and Squad 2, they have the journal from 9/11 open with what they did. You can see that when you come in the firehouse. It's really cool that all the different firehouses had different history like that to look at. So.
Right. Fantastic. Fantastic. Okay. Let's talk about the term aggressive and what it means to you.
You know, the engine companies in DC aggressive, you know, running the lines and just hitting the ground hard, being ready to go. I feel like the best analogy for aggressive to, in my mind is, you know, you hear guys say, well, basically, you got firemen are squared away who are essentially like the pit bull on a leash, and your job is to know when to hold them back. Otherwise, you know, as an officer, you would want somebody that's just ready to go. They're ready to go. They're squared away. They're dialed in on all of their stuff. You don't have to tell them which line to pull. You don't have to tell them how to go fight the fire or when to back off. You need to be, you know, the one that says, "Hey guys, this is not the one. You know, we're going to have to change our operation." But just taking the initiative on your own, on and off duty, to be prepared to make sure that you know your job. Like, I feel like that's a part of being aggressive. Your mindset is just as much as you are physically able to perform a task. So.
Okay. When you were growing up, were you always was the end goal always the squad, or do you have a favorite? Is it, what I'm trying to say is, do you have a favorite with the engine, a ladder, or has it always been the squad?
I think that what, like, when I first got in the fire department, I had no clue about what the difference is and all that kind of stuff, obviously. But you know, here in the volunteer world where I live, it's more engine company based because the guys don't understand the full ability or that, you know, the task that the truck can truly perform. Like if you ask the average guy in a small town fire department what the truck does, most of them would say that it's probably used as a you know, elevated platform for master streams for heavy duty operations. Whereas if you ask to you ask a fireman in an urban setting, you know, the more busy, you know, city type setting, they're used to make rescues. They're used for, you know, that kind of thing. So but for me, I started with the training with, you know, a bunch of different technical aspects of training and got into some of those classes, and it just the squad kind of piqued my interest more. So something I've always been interested in, wanted to do, and just kept pushing towards it. And I'm proof that if you work hard and chase your dreams, you can achieve them. So it's pretty cool.
Okay. All right. And with your background, with you starting as a volunteer, climbing through the ranks there, I remember you say earlier in the conversation, you rose up to the rank of fire chief. So with you now being a technician, feet down the line, where do you see yourself in the future? Do you see yourself as a captain on the squad, or some before you retire, a battalion chief, or
Yeah, well, so I was assistant chief in the volunteer firehouse, but that's a totally different comparison between there and, you know, response from home versus in-house staffing. Like, you know, everybody in the fire department and in the volunteer firehouse, except for a couple of career guys, are coming from home. So that's a totally different dynamic with not having, you know, consistent regular staffing, obviously. But I gotta be honest, man, I'm having a having an absolute blast as a technician, and I think that talking with some of the other guys, you know, when you know if it's time to move on and time to start to promote or whatever, and you know, then it's time to make that move. Before making it to the squad, I always said I wanted to retire as a battalion chief, but I guess we'll just have to see how things go.
Okay. I like your response on it because you mentioned how you just have to see how things play out. Because not everybody wants to get promoted, but it's usually one of those things that it'll kick in whenever, like you said it, when the time is right, you know. So the time is right. You put in the work. You got the technician role, which I'm sure is an amazing skill set, number one, because the rescue goes to all pin-ins, entrapments, and working fires within that area, correct?
Yep.
And so what is, besides driving, what would be your responsibility on the fire ground? Because I know everybody has a role.
So there's a lot of different takes on this, but the easiest way to explain it basically is, like, I'm sure you've heard of the Swiss cheese theory before, where, like, or for a mayday or something bad happened, or several different small events, basically lining up the different layers to make sure that we prevent the chance of something bad happening. So that would include, like, making sure that the engine company is, trying to help and make sure the engine company is getting the line in place, getting kinks out of the hose. If the wagon driver needs help with something, helping them out. Moving past that, if the truck company's not there yet, starting to, take the window, or if need be, or cut bars. We do a lot with cutting bars and forcing doors on outside to try and help open up the building to make it more firefighter friendly. And then obviously, if we have a report of people trapped or, a firefighter down, then that dictates, differently. We'll shift gears. But the initial size up coming in, listening to radio traffic, the size up from the initial officers, listening to the radio transmissions with those key phrases about, whether it's high heat and low visibility, or we're having trouble finding the fire, or I've lost someone. That's going to dictate what equipment that we bring to the front of the building, and then what our mode of operation is to begin with. We're staffed with a crew of five, so the officer takes one with them, and then the other two guys operate as a team. So, the officer would dictate whether they go to the fire or above the fire, and they take that one with them. On our shift, the officer goes to the fire, so the other team goes above. Depending on reports of if a victim was trapped, we may change that plan and go all towards where they're, reporting to be trapped, and then I'll just supplement wherever I can.
I love hearing the playbook. Okay. Next topic for you, training. I'm sure you guys definitely get your set of reps in, but how important is training? I mean, I could tell you outside looking in, the history of DC is always based around training. Whether you're on an engine, you're stretching lines, if you're on a ladder, you're throwing ladders, forcing entry, things of that nature. So how important is training?
From the fire ground perspective, we do a lot of stuff, specifically as a squad, we do a lot of stuff that can be advanced at times. But the base of all this is being really good at the basic skills on the fire ground. And if you can master the basic skills, then a lot of times the extra stuff, the crazy stuff, is probably not needed. Like, for us, we do some stuff with ropes. It's great to know all the technical stuff, but if we can do a simple system to make things work, we're going to choose simple over complex, just because it's going to be easier for everybody to understand and whatnot. I personally have a big interest in training. I think it's, number one, it's fun to share what and to watch other guys step into that and not just be able to go through the steps, but to be able to share the same information and show that they understand the concepts and they understand why, and that is, like, true ownership of the knowledge that you have to be able to share it. Getting those reps and actually physically doing it instead of just talking about it, for us, like, there's a one of those big controversial conversations about, do you wear your gloves coming off the rig, or do you put them on after you've masked up? There are a bunch of reasons that you could go both ways. For me personally, like, I chose to make a decision to mask up with gloves on. And so every day when I assume duty, you put your gloves on first, and then you get masked up. And next thing you've gotten to a level where you're unconsciously competent at putting your mask on, and it's not something that you have to focus on. So for us, when we get to the front of the building, while I'm sizing up the building, I don't have to think about which chin strap to pull or how that process is going to go, because I've built muscle memory to a point where it just happens naturally. So I'm not distracted by a mask issue. I'm able to fully take in the fire ground and read the building a little bit better to see what's going on before making entry, or identifying an issue that someone else might have missed, or relaying something to the guys that may help them get to something faster. Or we had a fire where we just happened to look down the street and see a lady's arm waving through the window through bars one time. Hey guys, grab the saws real quick. And we're able to, assist in being a part of, helping that have a good outcome. So if you're not focused on performing the basic skills, you're able to do other things to make you better on the fire
Okay. That last thing you said, that kind of sparked another question. So, you're housed with Engine 15. So if Engine 15 is out on like a med run, Does the squad pick up the next medrone in that area? How does that work? Or is it specific only that you guys on the squads only run particular calls?
So right now they do not dispatch the rescue squad on medical locals at all, unless it would be like a vehicle crash with entrapment or something like that. That's not to say that if there's a shooting close by or something legit close by that we wouldn't just mount on the rig and, head around the corner. It happens quite a bit. The guys will hear a shooting that's close by and realize that the engine company that's first due or closest ALS resources is coming from a little bit of ways away. It's pretty common for the engine to be out, the closest medic unit to be out, even for the EMS battalion supervisor to be out. So that does happen. The other thing for us is we have a lot of people that show up at the firehouse who've been shot or stabbed, requiring medical care, and they hit the doorbell. So, I mean, that probably happens once or twice a week consistently. So it's entertaining to talk about when it's not happening, but you'll be eating dinner and the doorbell rings and half the table gets up because you don't know what you're getting at the front door. It may be someone that's coming to stop by, or it may be somebody who's getting dropped off that's been shot. So definitely one of the rougher areas, but that keeps everybody on their toes and squared away skill wise. So
Okay. And do you guys still do I think it's called like a watch. Does that occur at your station?
yep. So, if you look in that journal that you were talking about, it would identify that someone's always on watch. For our firehouse, we do two watchmen. So typically it would start at like 11 or midnight, and that person stays up to answer the phones, make sure the company gets turned out if there's a run, answer the door if someone comes to the door, just to fail safe in case something with the alerting system doesn't go out. And then the second person would be like 2:30 until the first person from the next shift comes in. And they're getting there between 4 and 4:30. So, we probably do 2 hour blocks for two different guys. Some shifts do three. Some firehouses will do three watchmen just to make it shorter time, but that's
Okay.
it.
Okay. So just so for me and other listeners that are tuning in, so at the watch area, you have a telephone, you said. So if that telephone rings, is it someone from dispatch calling or just a general telephone?
So it's a general phone line for that anyone could call, but you could get a phone call from any of the other house. So our house is the battalion house that has the battalion chief in it. So if someone calls out sick in the middle of the night, they'll call their firehouse. So like let's just say, for example, engine 32, a member calls out. They have to notify the battalion fire chief that that person called out sick. So they'll call engine 15's quarters, and then we'll notify the battalion chief. And
Okay.
that's how that whole process goes. So,
Okay. And then a call in case you're alert, which in my station, I mean, my department, we have an alerting system. So if your alerting system is down or something happens, 911 just as a fail safe, they'll call the station and go, "Hey, you're getting ready to be dispatched to this."
yeah. So, each room in the firehouse has speakers, and we have the reader board that shows all the live active calls, right? A lot of times they'll notify if they're having issues with the system, or if hopefully that person that's on watch will catch if there's a call dispatched. But yes, if they're not responding within a very short amount of time, then the dispatcher would call and make sure that the company's getting turned out.
Okay. So, needless to say, whoever is on watch, like you really got to be on watch. You can't be sleeping because if you miss something, it can mess up the whole dynamics, I'm sure.
That's right. And then, inside each room in the firehouse, this is, I've seen this very many other places, but we have what we call a tree. It's a tubular set of lights with different colors. And if it's the ambulance's run, the blue light will go off. If it's the engine's call, it'll be red. If it's a squad, it's orange. And then if it's a chief or EMS supervisor, it's white. So, if you're laying in bed and somebody else is on watch, the light goes off along with the alerting system, and that tells you what units do. So if everybody's laying in bed and all the lights go off, it's something bad and it's really close. So,
Okay.
if the red, orange, white, and blue all go off, it's probably a box alarm or something legit that's really close by, and everybody just gets up and runs. So,
Okay. Okay. I like it. Like I
yeah.
said, you don't know what you don't know. So, cool system. Okay. Regards to training, what is your niche? What do you like to train on? What's your bread and butter?
My personal favorite thing to do, which I hope that we never have to use it, is stuff with firefighter down, packaging, air management, stuff like that. Like I said, I hope that we never have to use it on an actual fire ground, but I feel like that's something that we should all be really squared away with. So, going through the process of locating the firefighter, identifying their air management issue, fixing that appropriately, and then packaging and removal. And that could be from the basement, from the upper floors, from the roof. Think about the different locations that a firefighter could go down. And then the spin that I like to put on all of this kind of stuff is, if that scenario happens and you only have the stuff that you put in your pockets and the tools that you chose to bring into the building, let's think about the worst case scenario with the minimum tools that you could possibly carry. So a firefighter falls through the floor into the basement, and you only have the tools that you brought with you and the equipment that you chose to put in your pockets. Now, let's come up with some solutions for that to get them out, because that's going to be the worst case scenario. And then we'll build from there to, the squad driver hasn't made it in the building yet because we just pulled up and now a mayday occurs. I can call and ask them to bring specific equipment. What are you calling for? Versus we're two blocks out when the mayday comes across the radio. Now we get to choose, and all of us get to bring some equipment because we have all those hands here. So the progression from worse to it gets a little bit better, what are our options? And it kind of helps you break the cycle of, well, I just did this because, now we know that you have, specific tools and a method to start with. It's not necessarily say it's going to be the answer for that specific case, but we've done enough of a trial with packaging someone and trying to carry them up the stairs, and we found a way that is probably going to work fairly reasonably, So,
Right.
I'm all about all the different training stuff, but I feel like making sure that we can take care of our own is really important.
Yes. Yes. Okay. All right. And I mean the traditions training, man, that's in my book, that's big, because that's nothing but OG, what I call OG old heads, heavy hitters, guys with tons of knowledge that go around teaching what I call the Lord's work. Like, I mean, those dudes are all squared away. So I'm sure when you got that, like, hey, we'd like for you to come be a part of this, like, what was that like?
It's a very humbling, very exciting, opportunity, and hopefully I can make those guys proud moving forward with some of the stuff that I'm trying to put together and move out. You hear Chief Riley and a couple other guys talk about just being busy and not being able to do it as much as they want. And I would love to be able to be more involved with it. So, we'll have to see where road takes us with that as far as time and schedules. And some of the conferences are fun, and then talking about trying to do some stuff close to home and, maybe do some drill night stuff or something like that. So.
Okay. Love it. Love it. Love it. Love it. Next question for you. Where is it? I just had it here. Where is that? Okay, there it is. Which characteristic, in your opinion, holds more weight? Years of service, education, work ethic, or on-the-job experience?
I think that they go hand in hand. I think some of it is candidate dependent, because you could have a guy that doesn't have a degree but lived in a firehouse that was really busy, a PG County firehouse, or doesn't necessarily have to be there anywheres, but a place where they're able to get the experience. I think that some of that depends on the rank that you're trying to go for, but the lower ranks of the fire service need to have someone who is competent in being able to put fires out, recognize issues while also being a leader. So maybe the education isn't as important on the lower levels as being able to just have a concept of managing people and be able to make sure that they achieve their tactical goals, as opposed to, deputy chief, assistant chief, even battalion chief. There are certain aspects of that that there would be benefits to it, to having the degree. I also know a bunch of guys that don't have a degree that are fantastic fire ground commanders. So that's no reflection overall of anyone's ability. I think that maybe just might help them more on the administrative side of things when it comes to that kind of stuff. But you know, from our perspective too, like the battalion chief isn't worrying about some of the budgetary stuff that, you know, he's worrying about running the fireground. Whereas if you looked at some of the per se assistant chief level in a volunteer organization, they probably are saturated with some of that kind of stuff. Not to say that they need a degree, but just the difference in organization as far as what your responsibilities are. You know, it just depends on what that role is. But you know, there's a hot topic for us about 5 years of service versus 3 years of service for coming to the rescue squad. And you know, there are a lot of guys that are against it. I can see both sides of that conversation. I've seen some guys that have 3 years of service in DC that are fantastic firemen that will do great in a rescue squad company. I've also seen guys that have 15 years that just because they have the years of service, they probably don't have any business being anywhere near that or a fire truck at all. So it just, you know, all depends.
Right. No, I agree. I mean, years of service doesn't necessarily correlate to experience. I firmly believe it's up to the individual, number one, and number two, where they're stationed at. Now, there are some individuals who, by the luck of the draw, you really have no say so if the station that they place you in is busy or not. That's out of our control. But with that being said, usually the individuals that are at the busy stations get the experience, get that knowledge to become better, whether it's a senior firefighter, driver, company officers, whatever the case may be.
For sure. And you know, you can tell the guys that want to be there for the right reasons versus the guys who were assigned there. And then it's pretty interesting to watch. I mean, I don't have anything bad to say about Engine 26. It just wasn't what I was looking for. I wanted to be a part of something a little bit different. You can feel a difference in culture. The guys at 26 are great dudes. The area was really great. It had a great, you know, opportunity for a lot of commercial, great, you know, residential area as well. Just something about the different feel of the area being in Southeast and the culture of the way things work down there. And you can talk to the guys in the city. We all know each other. We all communicate very well, but there's definitely a significant difference in how the feel of the fire department is, you know, in Southeast versus Northwest and so on. And then, you know, you talk about some of the slower firehouses. They talk about the 5th Battalion being the retirement battalion, but there are a lot of super squared away guys that have just served their time in busy companies and are ready to kind of finish off a little bit slower, not be as
Right.
busy. But you know, there's exceptions to every rule, but you can tell that those guys are going to go to work when a fire comes in. So, yep, it's good. I mean, the busy companies give you the opportunity to get the reps. You know, for us, the engine company's running down the street. The truck companies are throwing ladders. You know, the first and second two engine companies and the first two truck and the first two chief are taking their assigned positions on every box along. So those guys are stretching every time there's a report of a fire. They're laying out every time there's a report of fire. The truck companies are throwing ladders every time there's a report of fire. They're not pulling up and saying, "Oh, I don't see any smoke, so we're just going to hold off." So, you know, they're building the muscle memory sometimes 6, 7, 8, 10 times a day if it's a busy day outside of their training. And then they're still racking their lines and re-racking them so that they're tight and making sure that they take pride in their equipment and helping people, you know, 20, 25 times a day. So it's a great place if you want to come get some experience, come be a medic or be an EMT and learn how to really enjoy the different facets of the job.
And from you going from 26 to 15, I'm sure you know when you first started, man, that had to have been a culture shock, right? Like the amount of runs, because I know talking to Steven, he's with Engine 30, he talked about how there are days, most days, like he packs a lunch with them because once they leave the firehouse, they might not get back until several hours later.
Yeah, I mean, 26 is a busy company too. You know, they're still doing the same amount of runs. You know, well, maybe not quite as many runs as some of the, you know, like 30, 15, 32, 27. Those guys are probably a little bit busier. 10 engine, definitely, you know, top five. You know, the guys on the ambulance definitely pack their lunch, and there's a good chance that you won't see them, but definitely busy, you know.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about leadership because it's one of those hot topics. And of course, like I said earlier, I mean, I misspoke, but you were assistant chief, even though to me, volunteer, career, part-time combination, it still encompasses, it's the same thing, just on different levels and different type of things you have to deal with. But leadership as a whole, we have lots of people who want to be leaders but don't want to take everything leadership has to bring, meaning when it comes down to I have to discipline somebody, I have to tell somebody where they're not cutting it, they need to do better. Like in my experience, it's easy for someone to say, hey, I want to be a lieutenant or a captain, but some of them have trouble doing what leaders need to do in uncomfortable situations.
For sure. Yeah. And then I would even take it a step further than that and say the ability as a leader to acknowledge and recognize when you've made a mistake and to own it, ownership of what you've done one way or the other. Like I'm one of those guys that I can only sit and watch somebody do something for so long before I feel like I need to take action one way or the other, whether that's on the fire ground or as a paramedic. And you just gotta make the decision and stand behind it. And if it's not the best decision, or if you've made a mistake, have the ability to say, I made the decision, I stand behind it. Like I would respect you much more if you said, I was wrong, but I made a decision and I defend it and I acknowledge that I need to do better in the future than to be wishy-washy and not really know what's going on. I think that there's much more respect for that pathway than to just be nervous or scared. Being able to do the job that you're trying to show somebody else, like definitely would never ask someone to do something that I wouldn't do. I feel like that's an important part of leadership as well. And then just more than just a basic understanding, like I feel like you should really know your job if you're going to be the leader. How can you hold someone else accountable to do a job if you don't know if they're doing it right or not? So.
Okay. All right. I like your stance on it. Take us through what on this kind of goes with the realistic training topic, but what would be some of the things Rescue Squad 3 does to show a newly, I don't want to say newly promoted firefighter, but like a new-ish firefighter who's on the squad, like what they do, like what kind of training, what kind of sets and reps do you guys do to get your members squared away?
That's a great question. We have a new 90-day candidate that starts on Sunday.
Okay.
So his first day will entail going through each compartment of the rig, starting off the day after he assumes duty, and pulling out every piece of equipment and showing him what it is and making sure that he understands what it is at least. We certainly wouldn't expect him to be able to operate everything, but at least have an idea of where the equipment is. And then we're going to go over searches. We're going to force doors. He's going to probably cut a car, the basic stuff that we have a high probability of doing. And then each one of those candidates has a 90, what do we call it, a 90-day book. When you become a candidate for the rescue squad, you have 90 days to complete this book, and it has a various number of skills, and you have to be able to show proficiency in those skills in order to be assigned to the rescue squad. So stabilizing a vehicle on its side, making the vehicle ready for extrication, actually physically performing an extrication to include removing the doors, roof, rolling a dash lift, lifting vehicles with airbags or hydraulic jacks, cutting stuff with chainsaws or rescue saws, torches, shoring, so building two post vertical or window door shore. We have metro stuff, so you could have to do metro with the WASOD and the hot stick. You could have to do metering. You could have to do various number of that kind of stuff. Rope systems, so twin tension systems, anchors, different knots, tying yourself in with a rescue litter and having to operate that, the skid or spec pack. And then another part of their test is searching for victims and re victim removal, and then firefighter down with the RIT scenario using the RIT bag. So those are just some of the scenarios that they're put through and some of their testing to be able to show proficiency that they're able to come to the rescue squad. So throughout the 90-day period, he'll get several opportunities to perform other skills and make sure this process is squared away. And then they have a final test. And if they pass the test successfully, then they get to transfer to the rescue squad.
Okay, so number one, that is a, and that's just a short version, but that's a plethora of things that they have to know. So my question to you is, like, let's just say me, I come or I test out. If there's something I don't know, I'm sure you guys will show them how to do it and then expect them to get it and then go, okay, now show us on your own without any help.
Yeah. So, you know, if the guy has never done whatever skill, ropes, whatever, we're going to show them how we would do it slow, show them how we would do it as a team to put that system together and then insert them into one of the roles. Take it slow and ask questions. Let's build their proficiency to the point where they're able to run the entire thing and tell us how to put it together and show that they know all the different parts of the system to build from there. Same thing with the firefighter down. Like, we're going to show you the rip bag. We're going to show you our process for orienting yourself to a down firefighter, how to identify if they're conscious or unconscious. Are they breathing or not breathing? Are they out of air? What's their air level? Okay, how do we work through the process of what's the easiest delivery for air all the way to the most difficult and the most IDLH exposure, and then address the issue. Okay, now you've addressed the air emergency. You know, now it's time to package them for removal. What are we going to do? And work through the entire process and then give them options and talk about different ways that it would be easy to remove a firefighter from the basement versus if we're just moving horizontally through the first floor and out the front door versus if we're on the second floor and now we have to lift that firefighter up and get him over a windowsill to get him out. What are some easy options from the inside or some stuff we could call for? Example, the high ladder kit. You know, you would put a ladder above the window with a pre-rigged 2-to-1 and have that come in the window and connect to them, and then we could just haul them up and lower them out a window. Or some simple ways, if the truck driver were to have an emergency on the roof in the middle of a fire, how are we going to easily get them down? So all those different conversations happen, and we work through those different skills amongst ourselves as a team with the engine company and the firehouse, and then we try to work with the different companies around us as well. And we'll put the newer guy in the position to be teaching some of that so that he has a chance to understand the concepts and then demonstrate his or her knowledge of the topic by teaching it. Because if you can teach it, you have to truly understand it. You can't just say, well, this is this and this is because that's the answer. Like, why? Why does that work that way? If you can explain why, then you can show more of a mastery of the knowledge.
Understood. Man, like it. I give. I'm very humble about things, and I'm telling you, man. Like, I know sometimes some people give the squad guys slack for, oh, you know, we ran up all night and the squad didn't get up once. But I'm telling you, man, that the stuff that you guys have to do, true Swiss Army knives of the fire service. I commend you guys. I commend anybody that's on a big city squad. That does the plethora of things because there's so much. Like, to me, that's brain overload. Like, my brain can only take so much. Do you guys still do dive?
We are not required to do dive. The fire department is in the infancy stages of having a team together. They have, I think, 12 members now who are, like, have all the gear issued and ready to go. I'm not sure what the ultimate direction for that's going to be. I know that within the last couple months, they've made some successful rescues and been involved in some recoveries, both from members that are at the fireboat and rescue squad members who were able to respond to the scene and don all their stuff and go. So it's moving in that direction. You know, I think it's a great thing. I hope that they continue to move forward with it and that it works out well.
Okay. The squad has a driver, an officer, and three firemen that are in the back. I'm assuming the other two, are they like the senior or is there ever a situation where you have like two somewhat newish firefighters in the back, or is it always just one paired with two senior guys?
Yeah, they would only allow to have one, what we call a 90-day candidate the other guys have to be assigned to the company, so or assigned to the special operations division. So, you know, if a couple guys took off, then they would hire overtime from another shift, or
gotcha.
Someone from another squad would be detailed there for the day.
Okay.
There's also members from the fireboat and members from hazmat who have the enough of the classes they're able to qualify as well. So there are guys that are eligible for it, but you have to have. Well, the idea is that you should have completed the 90 day in order to be able to do that.
Right, right. Okay. So they under no circumstance would they ever go, all right, we're pulling someone off engine 15 to go on the squad, even though you guys are side by side.
That used to happen quite a bit, and some things have changed, and that doesn't happen anymore like that. So,
okay. You know, okay.
Not, right. Not currently anyway.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, no, I mean, like I said, it's just the amount of knowledge you guys have to do. It's just like, you know, it's me giving my flowers, giving the credit to you squad members, because that's a lot of shit. You guys have to do a lot of stuff.
Well, to that, I would just say, like, you know, a lot of the stuff is perishable skills that if you don't keep up on it, it is
absolutely
easy to forget.
Right.
And, you know, there's a certain amount of that stuff that the numbers specifically or something like that may not matter. But there are some things also where the numbers absolutely matter. And if you were to get something wrong, then it would positively, you know, affect the fire ground or the operation in a negative manner. So, you know, like we did a confined space and hazmat combination drill for our research last tour. There's a lot of cool stuff that you can achieve with that, and you get to check off a lot of boxes for not just checking a check sheet, but being able to perform those skills and to refresh, you know, things. So, you know, the good thing about the 90-day process is when you have a candidate with you, you are all the members of the shift are doing those things and participating. So it keeps you fresh. It keeps you squared away, having to work through all the numbers and the processes. So it's a good thing.
Okay. All right. Communication. Communication is a big thing to me. Communication is probably one of the founding blocks to keep a department or a station or a crew together. So how important is communication for you, in your opinion?
It's huge. For us, you know, we have some, I don't want to say they're plays, but like, we have some playbook stuff where we're like, all right, well, this is what our plan is. Or this is what our plan A is for a vehicle on its side, or this is a plan of a vehicle on its roof. You know, when we get there and the officer and myself will go take a quick look at the vehicle and kind of get our size up of the scene while the other guys are starting to execute plan A. If plan A isn't going to work, you know, being able to communicate clearly is critical to making that audible per se and to make things work. We actually did a drill. I worked overtime the other day at Rescue Squad 2, and we did a simple drill where you had your coat, your hood, your helmet, your mask, gloves on, and they give you the rip bag. You have a downed firefighter, and you just have to locate them. And between you and your partner, you had to deliver air based on whatever the emergency was and then package them. But you had your mask obscured so that you couldn't see. And being able to communicate, picturing in your mind, like, all right, well, I found his SCBA. So, hey, man, put your hand on the top of a cylinder. Now move your hand down to the bottom of a cylinder. Now move it to the left. Now you're going to feel the RIC-UAC connection. All right, cool. Now that you've located it, I need you to do this. Or when it comes time to package, like, I personally am not a fan of using the waist strap conversion. So I carry a couple different variations of webbing so that no matter what situation I find, I can adapt accordingly. Well, trying to tell someone what you're trying to achieve when you can't see, you're forced to be able to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
So therein reinforces the same thing again, like mastery of the basic skill that you're trying to achieve to the point where you can do it with gloves on, and then to the point where you can do it with gloves on and no visibility, gives you the freedom to be able to execute that without being maxed out on your brain capacity, and you can still think, you know. So that's, you know, that's one of those things that, and not just there too, like as simple as if the guy's going to call out tomorrow, like communicate that with the ship so that we can make sure staffing is squared away for the rescue squad if we can. Like communication is important across all avenues of it. And, we're a family. We work together. We spend time outside of the firehouse together. Working on communicating together is good.
You said you just said about the waist strap conversion. That's all I knew growing up in the fire service. That's all I was taught. And then I went to an outside training event, and the instructor was like, "How many of y'all do this?" And of course, I raised my hand. I'm like, "Yeah." I was like, "That's all I've been shown." And he's like, "Well, here's another option." And he pulled out this piece of webbing with two clips on a carabiner, and he's like, "This is how I do it." And I was like, "Oh," like blew my mind, because that's all I knew was waist strap conversions. And so he's like, "This right here takes all the play out of it." He's like, "It's good that," he's like, "I'm not taking away that whoever taught you that." He's like, "But when it's going down, when it's really bad, it's super dark, you won't be able to see." So when he showed me his, it was just I forgot the name of the webbing, but it's just webbing. And then he was like, "I have glow in the dark tape that on each end and on the strap that I pull." And he's like, "You will be able to see it in the dark." And you just like, I did it a couple times while I was at that training event, and that's what's in my right pocket. I have two straps just for that. It's a game changer. And you don't know this unless you get out of your wheelbox and take some classes or listen to some dudes that,
For sure.
like I look at you as you have the experience I don't have. I am very humble and open. The amount of stuff that you see in DC, I do not see in my department. So if you're like, "Hey, this is what I do, on a situation like this," your experience counts, and I'm gonna listen to it and try it, for myself.
We have a responsibility to take the information that happens from other places amongst ourselves and apply it so that we try to reduce that of happening again. So, we're close to Baltimore City, and we have a lot of friends that work there. And the information that came from Stricker Street, and then their most recent double line of duty death, with hearing about some of the waist strap issues, it just kind of drove home for us that there's got to be a better way for us to consistently package. And I got to thinking, all right, well, if there's a way that I can package by avoiding using the waist straps, if I can package that firefighter in a way that I can move horizontally through the building, and then also if that firefighter were to fall through a hole, whether it's into the basement or whatever, and we need to go to a vertical hauling situation, to not have to change anything about the way I packaged them. Like if I package you the same way every time, and it's going to work for all these different scenarios, and take the stress off of whether the SCBA straps have thermal damage or damage from structural components falling on them. If I eliminate that as a failure option by bringing my own webbing to the game, then we're only going to set ourselves up for success. So the department issued every firefighter 20 foot of webbing, tubular webbing with a carabiner. So I took a piece of rope and put the rope in the center point of the loop, and then made handles with rope in the handle so that with gloves on, it's a little bit easier to identify what you have. And then we drilled and drilled and drilled, probably for a month straight, on every conceivable way you could think of to package to achieve the goal of not putting stress on the SCBA straps while being able to drag horizontally and vertically. And we finally came up with a system that works, like drip the loop over the cylinder, go between his legs, and then come over his head. And when you go back through that loop, it kind of creates a basket, and you clip right on a carabiner. It works great. I'm sorry, a girth underneath of the loop over his bottle keeps the cylinder in place. It works great. We did it several times, with zero visibility or low visibility with gloves, and that goes to another thing. Like it's easy to do a drill where you lay a fireman down in the middle of a room with nothing around them and nothing on the floor. Let's be honest, if that happens, they're probably going to be in a pile of clothes in the corner or under a huge pile of debris or under a large heavy beam. And that goes back to the realistic training. Like we're selling ourselves short by doing a drill that's not realistic. So I would rather slow things down and take the time to do it right so that, sure, it's a little harder. You guys got to work a little harder, but now you have the real, more close to the real thing. Instead of, well, I'm just gonna, I think somebody called it the halo or something like this. I'm not 100% sure on the term or what it is, but like the victim's laid out, and if picture with me if you will, like the chalk line for what the cops would draw, right? The guy's arms and legs are spread all the way out, and then they're going to take this webbing and make a big circle around them and move it in different directions. That's great if you're on a hard floor with nothing on the floor around them, no furniture or anything else. Like, for us, we're probably going into a row home that's cluttered with stuff stacked 3 feet on each side, and that just ain't going to work. So you have to find something that's realistic for you to be able to achieve in a dark, zero visibility environment, high stress, with your gloves on, and be able to make it work. So that's the goal for everything that we start with our training. I have a class that I was doing with Traditions, Assessment Management of a Downed Firefighter. I would love to see the opportunity to be able to do that class and put a dummy with an SCBA on in the basement of a building and have some sort of air emergency that needs to be addressed. But we create a smoky environment, whether it's through a barrel or through smoke machines or whatever. We put some heat in there by using the burn barrel or using a torpedo heater to give you a little bit more realistic environment. We have a cassette tape that's playing the sound of water flowing and the sounds of a saw run and glass breaking, people screaming. Like, create an environment that's closer to realistic so that you have the additional stressors. Let's get your heart rate up a little bit. And now we're going to go to work and you're not going to be able to just get out. So if we're working through the scenario and your vibe alert goes off, well, guess what? You got to tag out. So now we've either got to provide you with an air solution or we've got to switch you out with another member. So now we're working into the 45 minutes to an hour of working on trying to get somebody out. What solutions are you going to bring to the game to get the beam off or to cut them free or whatever? Or if it's a, bucket brigading a rubble pile off of the firefighter, like, let's do all that in the environment that it's going to be like, because then you have something similar to revert to if it ever happens, and your confidence level is going to be there to the point where you're not going to just be, running around like a chicken with your head cut off trying to come up with a solution. So that's where my mind goes when I'm laying in bed at night trying to get settled. So the guys in the back of the squad are like, why are we doing this drill? Because we're just trying to make ourselves a little bit better.
Oh, absolutely. Dude, yes, I love it. I like, because it's very easy. And if anyone out there does this with their companies, man, still little steps, that's great if you go out and train and do things like that. But to me, adding those little stressors of the noise, because that's how it's really going to be, getting that crew's heart rate up, because when that time comes, you're not going to be calm. You're gonna have a bunch of things going through your head. You're gonna have a bunch of radio traffic. Your pulse is gonna be high. You're gonna be breathing heavy, and that's the time. If we can do that in training and do it correctly, we should have no issues when it comes down to. Hopefully, you'll never have to do this out in the real world, but we have to be realistic about this job. It could happen.
And then the other part of that is just understanding the process for those types of calls to the point where, like, I'll give you an example. We did this recently with a firefighter down and in a basement smoked out, and they get down there and they're yelling at each other trying to communicate, and the pass alarm's still going off. Something as simple as, hey man, let's manage the sound so that we can think clearly and talk and communicate without there being an issue. All right, we came in and we had to go down two full flights of stairs to get into the basement. Have another company do a size up from the trolley side. We're fortunate to know that this is our training building and it has a walkout basement that has five steps. But like in your brain tells you in a normal environment that you want to go back out where you came from. Have somebody take a look, and for us, we're preaching it to our RIT company. Take the size up of the building and find those other exits, because just because we came in that way, I might have to move you horizontally across the basement. But if I have to drag you across a flat surface to move you out four steps versus having to carry you up two flights of stairs, I'm picking that every day, unless there is some reason that it doesn't make sense, be a fire or collapse potential or something like that. So, all the little steps of the and pieces of the puzzle add up to, success ultimately.
Well said. Well said. Love it. Love it. Eric, man, I appreciate you coming on, coming
Absolutely.
and talking the gospel, dropping some gems and tips and tricks for others out there to listen. Like I said, man, I truly appreciate, like I truly do, when I say this, I really do. I truly appreciate all DC does. And it's because of the individuals I follow and what they post, but you just see the I love seeing a fire department that holds its traditions very high. They continue to do it moving forward, showing the new generation, hey, this is how it's done. I just have to say thank you for coming on and talking shop.
Absolutely, man. I've had an absolute blast.
I am really proud that you, I mean, we had to put this interview off a little bit because you're studying, trying to get that technician position, and you were able to do that. I can't imagine the amount of work that you had to put in to getting it. To me, it's
Appreciate it,
always,
man.
even though it's not me, it's always a pleasure seeing somebody put in the work and reaping the reward of getting that position that you wanted.
I appreciate it, man. It's been a pleasure, for
Yes,
sure.
sir. Yes, sir. No, like I said, thank you, man. And this was a good conversation.
Absolutely.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.